Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, we talk about ideas and strategies and frameworks. We talk about protocols that worked. I tell stories of things that worked for me, but also those big epic fails that I've made along the way. I interview experts who share their insights, and I do all this because I believe to my core that teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential. And so today we're going to be talking about this idea of empowering students with voice and choice, how to fix this challenge of student engagement. And I want to say before we get started, please, if you haven't done so yet, subscribe to this podcast by clicking the little subscribe button. Like this podcast if you enjoy it. Tell a friend about it as well. Also, if you want to hear more and find some free resources and all kinds of stuff like that, please subscribe to my newsletter. You can find it at the bottom of the page on spencereducation.com. And every Thursday, for the most part, I send out a newsletter with resources, articles, podcast posts, all kinds of stuff like that, straight to your inbox. So check that out as well. Without further ado, let's jump into today's podcast episode. And it's all about the five biggest fears that kept me from empowering my students with voice and choice. Student engagement is harder than it used to be, but the answer is not more control or better entertainment. It's found in helping students move from compliance to true ownership, where they have voice, choice, and responsibility in their learning. So what does that mean? What does that look like? Well, let's start about this idea, or with this idea of moving toward student empowerment. And I want to begin with the recognition that student engagement is hard right now. It's no surprise that student engagement has been challenging lately. For well over a decade, we've seen the proliferation of social media leading to short-term dopamine cycles. And I addressed that in my last article, my last podcast episode as well, where students want instant gratification. If you've read The Anxious Generation, he gets into this pretty well as a thinker and a scholar. So it's the notion of the stimulus, dopamine boost, instant happiness, and then a crash that happens afterwards. And that makes school challenging. This has accelerated post-pandemic. And again, some of that might have to do with things like trauma. We want to recognize there's a lot of different factors. But it's not because kids just stopped caring. I don't believe in the notion that kids don't care. We've asked them to learn in a world that is louder, faster, and more distracting than ever. It's a space where their phones are designed to steal their attention at all times. It's no surprise when teachers feel like they have to compete with a culture of this constant amusement. Add in the social and academic aftershocks of the pandemic, the rising rates of anxiety, and the constant sense of uncertainty. And well, I don't know. It makes sense that students show up in a little more guarded and more tired and in a way where they're going to be a little quicker to check out. I want to be clear. This isn't always the case. When I visit classrooms, I see many glimmers of hope. In fact, I just came back from coaching mock trial, which I've talked about on this podcast before. That always makes me hopeful, like super duper. I guess super duper makes me sound so corny, but I become really, really excited. I see students sparking deeper, authentic learning through design challenges, inquiry-based activities, problem-solving, Socratic seminars, all kinds of stuff like that. I see deep discussions that give me hope for the future, but I do recognize it's an uphill battle. And I hear this from some of the best teachers I know. It seems to be taking like twice the amount of effort to get students to be fully committed and focused in class. Even when students want to engage, they are often working with less focus, stamina, and with less patience for anything that feels irrelevant. So engagement is now less about hype and more about helping students rebuild that attention, that trust, and that reason to lean in. So how do we improve student engagement? Well, Philip Schlechte talks about the notion of helping students become fully engaged, to move beyond what he called strategic compliance. And that happens by improving both your focus and your attention. But we can also move it past simply engagement and into empowerment. If we think about it this way, compliance is I'm doing it because I have to. Engagement, I'm doing it because I want to. But empowerment is all about I'm doing this because of a sense of deeper ownership and buy-in. Now, I want to point out, compliance has a place in school, and engagement obviously has a place in school. We need students to be engaged. But we also want to help them build that sense of empowerment. And yet, sometimes it's tough to do as a teacher. And the reason why is we get afraid. And so I want to share 5 reasons why we sometimes get scared. And these are reasons that were true of me. So some of these might resonate. Some of them might not. I have no idea. This is just, you know, where I'm coming from. When I first started out as a teacher, I was the tour guide. I led students through the content, I confused entertainment for engagement. Each lesson was carefully packaged, had an amazing presentation, and I would entertain my students as I taught social studies, and I would point out areas of interest. I was a tour guide. A few students might ask questions here and there, and on a good day, we would have a good discussion. But we never left the tour bus. We stuck tightly to the route spelled out by the curriculum map, stopping every few days to take on a new standard and to tackle a new objective. When students were bored, I doubled down on this entertainment factor. When they were confused, I simplified my explanations. But we were all going the same direction, in the same pace, in the same way. And I was driving the learning. Although I believed in the idea of student empowerment, I was scared. So let's tackle these fears. Fear number one, classroom management might suffer. I was terrified that students would turn their freedom into anarchy. Would the emphasis on empowering students lead to misbehavior? Would they challenge the classroom rules and go crazy? Or would the lack of emphasis on grades simply mean students refuse to do any work? I had been in the classroom before, like different ones I visited, that were wild and chaotic, where teachers said, "This is controlled chaos," but for me, it felt terrifying. Was this simply a cost of student ownership that I had to pay attention to? The reality is this. There were some challenges. And I had to learn how to rethink classroom management. But I found that classroom management actually turned out to be easier when I emphasized student ownership. I had to go over expectations about volume and movement and safety for sure. We negotiated the rules and procedures together. We did this something called a procedure grid, a rituals grid. But what I found is that when I focused on this proactive side, when I set clear expectations, when we did the rituals grid together, when I reduced the cognitive load, when I gave them scaffolds and support, well, what happened was that classroom management actually became easier. Fear number two, students wouldn't pass the test if they were choosing the topics. I remember being terrified that students would fail the test if they were working in a student-centered, choice-driven environment. It seemed like transfer wasn't going to happen, and they would go from like collaboration and creativity and choice and high motivative, you know, engaging assignments to this boring, standardized, irrelevant, solitary, one-size-fits-all test. Now, the reality is mixed here. on some level, that was true. Often when I empowered students to own the learning, I was able to teach above the test. I'll get into that in a second, but sometimes it didn't fit. Sometimes the questions and the style of questions were a challenge, and I had to teach them how to take tests, believe it or not. But the key thing is I didn't emphasize every aspect of the test. I didn't spend all of my time teaching to a test. I taught above the test. Simple areas of student choice paid off on standardized tests. For example, they had developed a really long reading endurance because the choice-driven reading that we did led to the ability to really focus for a long amount of time. They knew how to think through the hard questions because they'd been answering hard questions. And what I learned is that I could work through multiple levels of choice menu, from embedded choice to simple choice menus to advanced choice menus to full-blown independent projects. And what I did is something I've talked about a lot on this podcast is I used what's called the gradual release of responsibility approach. So gradually adding more and more and more and more choice. This allowed me to incorporate something called compacting. Now, there's a whole podcast episode on compacting. I'm a huge fan of it, but what it meant is students who had mastered certain standards didn't have to spend time in class taking them. They could move to other standards where they were still struggling. So in the end, yes, the test is a different format, and that sucks. And yes, I had to teach them, literally teach them how to take tests. We would spend about 2 days on that. But I will say this, they scored better. In the end, my students had the highest scores in the district, and in a way that was shockingly high. Fear number three. We won't cover everything on the curriculum map. This was a big one. I remember looking at the curriculum map and thinking, this is so crowded. If I try to do things like Genius Hour or project-based learning, we'll never get through it all. I didn't have the time or the space to add something new. Don't get me wrong. I knew that I could combine a few standards, but how would I actually make this work? Well, here's my reality. At first, I viewed things like design thinking, PBL, inquiry-based learning as additions. These were things I added to my plate. But what I realized is that these strategies are actually a different way of organizing your plate. And so how do I address this? How do I fix this? Well, again, compacting is part of it. Combining standards is part of it. Simplifying and choosing your power standards is part of it. But on top of all of those methods, doing things like inquiry-based sprints, single-day lessons, short little moments where we take a question break in the middle of direct instruction, all of those add more voice and choice in ways that are simply more feasible. Fear number four, students won't know what to do if they own their learning. I knew that if I said, hey class, you choose the content, the strategies, the assessment, go! Students would be lost. They would hit cognitive overload. They would be overwhelmed. Some students needed structure. Every student needed some type of structure. They all needed systems. So although I wanted to empower students, I knew that I had to give them a tool set to own the learning. So here's a reality. I began to do certain things, taking a gradual release approach that I brought up, so gradually getting more choice-driven, designing systems for self-assessment and peer assessment, and reusing those protocols on a regular basis, conferencing with students to help them self-reflect and monitor their own progress, creating structures for project management, doing onboarding processes for student voice and choice. Again, just making it more feasible, taking tiny steps, and going iterative rather than just jumping straight into it. Even then, some students are going to struggle with student voice and choice. This is why I created a scope and sequence of how I would introduce additional ownership throughout the school year. So I planned out a year-long plan, again, taking a gradual release of responsibility approach for this idea of student voice and choice. Fear number five, I was worried that my leaders would view student ownership as teacher laziness. What would the principal think if she saw students working individually in pairs and in groups at the same time? Would she think I'd given them free time and they were just working on whatever they wanted to do? Would she think I was ineffective or weak or just hands off, which I was not? The reality is that most principals, and I want to say most, not all, most principals will embrace this idea if it's structured, if it's responsible, and if it's clear. If they see the results, they will lean into it. My principals love the fact that I embedded intervention into the lessons and that students were aware of the progress. In fact, so much so that they could walk in and they could say, what standards have you mastered? What standards have you not mastered? And my students could give them an answer to that. For a few things, I did have to say to my principal, I would like to pilot this, and if it doesn't work, I'll scrap it immediately. And that's okay, right? Sometimes you have to do, and this reference is going to go over a lot of people's head, and you might want to unsubscribe right now, but sometimes you have to pull an Elton John and just simply say, take me to the pilot. You have to say, I am going to pilot something new. In the end, I was afraid of student ownership. However, I was more afraid of what would happen to students if they never owned the learning. And ultimately, I jumped into this uncertainty, and it worked sometimes. Okay, the truth is I made a lot of mistakes along the way, and you will too. But you're already making mistakes. And what you're doing right now isn't perfect either. I had moments of crushing self-doubt when I wondered if I was crazy for believing students could own their learning. I sometimes provided too much student ownership, sometimes not enough, and you know what? That's okay. It's a little bit like overcorrecting when you drive a car. But I also saw the transformation that happens when students own the learning. I watched them fall in love with the learning process as they chased their geeky interests and they asked hard questions. I saw them embrace the maker mindset, which is why, for all the mistakes I made, I am convinced of this. There is power in student ownership. And it takes us as educators being courageous enough to empower them with voice and choice. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify or wherever it is that you get your podcasts? Also, again, check out my newsletter at spencereducation.com. And if you are a decision maker who does PD, or I guess who decides on PD, I would love to work with your teachers on this idea of helping students with a voice and choice so that we can improve this issue of student engagement. So I do keynotes and workshops all around the country and actually around the world. And so check it out. Let me know. Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.